Okay, first of all, I hope I don't need a translator for my accent. English as she should be spoken from Scotland. Also, secondly, for me, this is like coming down the tropics, and I feel very warm in this room already, but hopefully things won't heat up too much. I want to say, actually, I don't mean to be rude. Actually, that's not true. I usually manage to offend everybody, so be offended if I don't offend you during the course of the evening. I've missed you out. But I hadn't quite expected people in Bedford to be so warm and so welcoming. So far, you've been a great bunch. My first time down from the wilds of Scotland to London, I was on the tube. And it seemed to me that everybody was talking to everybody else, and there was this rather, I have to admit, rather good-looking lady sitting, you know, kind of knee-to-knee to me across the tube. So I said, "Hi." And the whole tube went silent. And she looked down at her book and went a bit red, and I thought, oh, they must all know each other. And so I said, "My name's David. I'm from Scotland." And she started going. And people looked at me as though I was some kind of paedophile or something. I thought, oh. And my friend, after I told him this, burst out laughing and said, "You don't talk to strangers on the tube." So I thought about that today, actually, when I was on the train from London to here, and there was a lady sitting opposite me, and I wanted to talk to her and say, "Hi, my name's David, and I'm a Christian minister," and I wanted to, but I realized you can't do that, of course, in this culture, the panic that would have caused in that poor woman. Anyway, that's what I am, but I'm also somebody who likes discussing things, and I guess I want to say to my fellow atheists, because you know, of course, that the early Christians were called by the Greeks atheists. So I kind of expect that there are some of you here who are atheists or agnostics or whatever. I hope we'll be able to discuss these things. I'm amazed at how much passion gets induced by these kind of things. And I use irony a lot and sarcasm, so don't get too wound up, please, and let me out of here alive. I want to say, actually, though, that in terms of debate and discussion, I much prefer an honest atheist to a dishonest Christian. There's no question. And I think of, always struck by the words of Jesus when he talks about one particular church, where he says, "You're neither hot nor cold, therefore I want to spew you out of my mouth." And I think there's almost a sense in which, actually, Richard Dawkins' book I really appreciated precisely because it was so passionate. I thought much of it was wrong, I thought some of it was right. But at least I thought, there's some passion in there, and little did I realize just quite how much passion would be engendered. I think I want to ask something about, say something about the God delusion. This is really, I'm going to try and go through some of this, and then we will open up for questions. I walked into Waterstones and saw the God delusion as the number one book, and did what I always do, being living up to the stereotype of the Scot. I took the book, went up to Costa's, sat and read it, and then put it back on the shelf. But I have since then bought 3 copies. I've worn it through. I've read the book about 20 times. And it has astounded me that since that day, the God delusion has been and still is a bestseller. Coming down the railway station, even in a tiny W.H. Smith in, I think it was in Bedford, actually, there was several copies of the God delusion. Why is it so popular? Well, let's say, first of all, it's extremely well written. Academic books that are dead boring, even I really, really struggle with them. But this one, it was actually a page-turner. For me, it was actually better than Dan Brown, The Da Vinci Code. Just as ludicrous, but no, I shouldn't have said that. But it was well written. The other thing is, I think it's so popular, is it's unambiguous. You don't read The God Delusion and think, Richard Dawkins is sitting on the fence. And people quite like understanding what someone is saying. The other thing is that it's generally entertaining and informative. There are bits of it that make you want to laugh. And certainly there's lots of information in there. And then I think it's had fabulous publicity. Dawkins knows that he can phone up and the editor of the Times or the Telegraph, the Guardian, whatever. He's got a great publicity machine behind him. That's the world we live in. We live in a world of marketing, and the God delusion has been superbly marketed. I also want to ask, why did he write it? Now, I think some people are very unfair when they say, oh, he's just in it to make money. Of course he's made money from it. But there's no indication at all in either the book itself or from what I know of him personally that he's done it just to make money. He doesn't really need to. He's got a good job. He's made plenty of money from his excellent scientific writings. I think he wrote this largely because he actually genuinely believes it. I think he wanted to put his views across. He's always, as Prospect magazine said, Dawkins has always had a big fat book on God in him. But I think there's something else as well. And this is speculation. I think there's a fear and an anger also. And it comes from this. In the year 2000, just to give you an example, The Economist magazine published a millennium edition of that magazine, and they had an obituary for God, because that was it. The 20th century had got rid of God. It was just going to all die. About, I think, 3 or 4 months ago, I got a copy of The Economist, and there was an apology for that obituary, saying, we got it wrong. And they published a 16-page special insert on God returning to Europe. Now, God had never been away, but generally, secularization theory, the view that a society becomes more industrialized, more advanced, more educated, and so on, people will become more secular, that theory is now almost completely rubbished. And virtually no respectable sociologist would teach it. And what's happened is there's been a resurgence of interest. You have, for example, secular states like the United States, where religion is far more predominant than here. But even in Britain, the one city in Britain where the church is growing, do you know where that is? London. And it's growing enormously, not just from immigration, though a significant part is with immigration. But in my own country, in Scotland, you find that where the church is growing is in the cities. And again, not just from immigration. What's happening is that young urban professionals, many people coming out of university, are coming to a faith in God, a faith particularly in Jesus Christ, and that really scares people like Dawkins. He's in Oxford University, and the Christian Union there and the churches there are generally thriving. And for Dawkins, that is a genuine puzzlement, and it causes him some fear. And then he looks at a situation like 9/11, and I doubt he genuinely believes this, that somehow 9/11 is a view of the resurgence of religion or the danger of religion. And in Dawkins' minds, he puts together Islamic extremists who fly planes into buildings with Baptists from Bedford and Presbyterians from Scotland. Now, we don't fly planes into buildings, you know, and yet Dawkins does, and he makes it quite explicit. He says moderate religion provides a base for extremist religion. I'm not sure if he genuinely believes that, but I'm certain of this, that he has used that in his book to attack all forms of religion. And I think one of the things that's in there is a fear, just a fear that maybe we haven't killed the beast yet, and maybe religion will return. And maybe belief in God is a lot more predominant than people would like to have thought. People get, as I said, people get very emotive and very angry about this subject, and that intrigues me. I did write a response to Richard Dawkins. I'm a Scotsman, so I don't show my emotions. And when I read the book, I was amused, angry, irritated, stimulated, and so on. So I write things, and I wrote it down. And my church, my denomination, is called the Free Church of Scotland. I think in order basically to get me sidelined and shut up, they let me write on the internet. And I write a column, and I wrote an open letter to Richard Dawkins, which, much to my amazement, got published on his website. Now, I actually didn't even know he had a website. I've had some interesting experiences on that website. Kind of wish I'd never gone there, or I'd never been put there, but never mind. But one of the things that got me was when I discovered people's reactions was just how angry people are. Now, it's very difficult when you're writing on the web or on the internet and email. It's very difficult to judge tone. And it's very difficult for people, you know, people publish anonymously and they say things they would never say in public to anyone else. And maybe I'm as guilty of that as anybody else. So you have to be quite careful in assessing these things. But even so, there was an extraordinary amount of emotion. And I find that in Richard Dawkins himself as well. Why? I'm still puzzled by it. Another thing that I thought about Dawkins' book and why it's so popular is that it tells people what they want to hear. Now, that may seem a bit daft. Surely Dawkins' book, they would say, you as a Christian, you're worried about Dawkins' book because it's out to convert Christians to atheism. No, it's not. That's not even remotely its connection. I think what Dawkins is doing is expressing what he believes, and it's expressing what he thinks, and I actually think he's correct in this. Probably the majority of people in this country, and a significant minority of people in the United States, live like. In other words, most people in this country would not say they were atheists. I think 19% said they were atheists, or 20% in the recent survey that was done. But most people live as if there were no God. So, you might be here tonight, for example, and say, I'm not an atheist. But actually, it doesn't make any difference to you or not whether God is alive or not, because you live as if there were no God. And what Dawkins is seeking to do is to provide a justification for that living and to provide an intellectual reason for the way that most people live. Now, having said what I said in terms of praise about the book, I have to say this. What surprised me, there are certain things that surprised me. One is that there are absolutely no new arguments in it whatsoever, and I mean none. I'm very interested in philosophy, I read a lot of atheist books. There are actually some considerably better atheist books that explain the atheist case better and have caused me much more worry and concern than Dawkins' book. And I think, well, what was he doing? And you know, I think what he was doing is very simply this. He didn't care about the intellectual response. He has been slated, even by some of his fellow atheists, for the polemical manner in which the God delusion is written, for the slapdash philosophy, and for the actually rather sad use of argumentation that he does. And particularly things like the ad hominem arguments, that is where he'll say someone like Fred Phelps of Westboro Baptist Church, who's an absolute nutcase. And some Christians may be surprised to say, what were you saying? You just saying this, but no, I'm saying this about Fred Phelps. He's the man whose family basically stand outside the funerals of American soldiers and say, you know, your son died because God hates you. And he has, you know, I think his website is godhatesfaggots.com. Now, the man is perverse. He's perverse and he's obscene and he has nothing to do with Christianity. I have no qualms about saying that at all about him. But yet Dawkins cites him in The God Delusion just as an example of what happens when religion gets hold of you. Now, that kind of argumentation is frankly ludicrous and deeply unfair. And so Dawkins got slated for that. But I came to the conclusion that what he's really doing is he's telling people what they want to hear, and in particular, he's repeating what I called atheist myths, the Dawkins letters challenging atheist myths. What are some of these atheist myths? Well, a myth, of course, is something that you believe without really having thought about it. For example, it's a myth that all Scottish people are mean. We are the most generous and kind and open-hearted people in the world. It's a myth that all English people are snobby. That's just not true. It's a myth that if you live south of the Watford Gap, you are necessarily a conservative. You know, there's a whole range of images and myths that people have. We don't really think about them. And some of them are completely harmless, and some of them do a great deal of harm. There are religious myths, of course. But in terms of atheist myths, I list about 10 of them. There's 3 of them I want to mention tonight. One is the myth of the science-religion conflict. This, to me, is one of the most absurd myths of all. The notion that science and religion are necessarily opposed to one another. Now, that's deeply ingrained in our society. And yet it doesn't make sense. I'm in a church which is beside a science research institute, the Wellcome Trust building, and several of their top scientists worship in my church. In fact, most of my congregation, if you count medics as scientists, doctors as scientists, which I'm kind of hoping that they are, then most of my congregation are scientists. The next biggest group are actually artists and musicians, which is very interesting. Put the two together and it gets very interesting. But there is no inherent conflict between science and religion. Yet, since the days of Aldous Huxley, it has suited certain people, including Dawkins, to perpetuate this myth. And it is an absolute myth. Second myth is the myth of the inherent evil of religion. According to The Guardian in a poll in November last year, the majority of people in Britain now believe that evil, that religion is a primary cause, if not the major cause, of a lot of evil in the world. Dawkins cites, I think it's Daniel Dennett's phrase, and for me an absurd idea, that there are bad people in the world who do bad things, there are good people who do good things, but to get good people to do bad things, you've got to have religion. Now, I hate that fundamentalist view of looking at the world. It's the George Bush view of looking at the world, where you say, hey, there's the bad guys over here, and there's the good guys over here, and the good guys are going to get the bad guys. And I find it absurd that a scientist of Dawkins' intellect is saying there are bad people and there are good people. There's not. We're all messed up people. I mean, I'm a Scottish Calvinist, so I say we're all bad. But I'm actually also a Scottish Christian Calvinist, and believe you me, there are some people who say that they're Scottish Calvinists and they don't believe in God. An atheist Calvinist, that's an interesting one. And I'm a Christian, and I believe that there is good and bad in absolutely everyone. I don't think I can look at anyone and say, you are so bad that you no longer really belong to the human race, or you're so lost that I can't even speak to you. And I'm not going to look at anyone, not even you good folks here, and say, you are so good, you're like an angel. No. All of us have got good and bad within us. And the idea of the inherent evil of religion. Of course, religion does a great deal of harm, precisely because it's human beings that do the harm. Now, if you want a more academic and intellectual and realistic appraisal, you need to read someone like Miroslav Volf, who is a Croatian theologian who struggled with this whole idea of the Bosnian situation and the hatred that he saw and everything involved in that. And in his book, he comes up with the not-too-radical notion, which is easily provable, that people hurt people, and they'll use what they can. They'll use religion. Let me put it this way. My argument would be simple. In my work, I meet a lot of people who've been harmed because of sex. They've been sexually abused, or they've been sexually promiscuous, or they've got STDs, or something like that. Do I then turn around and say, sex has done a great deal of harm to these people? We don't need sex. Let's stop sex. I haven't discussed this with my wife, but no. You know, it would be stupid to act like that. Or money. You know, money is a root of all kinds of evil. Actually, it's not. The Bible doesn't say that. The Bible says the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Now, money's done a great deal of harm. Materialism is a real curse in our culture. Are any of you here going to say, that's it? There's my wallet, there's my credit cards, I'm emptying my bank account, mind you, the way things are going, that's probably going to happen anyway, but I'm not having anything more to do with money, it's evil. No, because you know that it's people abusing money, it's people abusing sex. And it's the same thing with religion. You will find that people abuse. Listen, if you want to exploit people, be religious. Invent a cult. You know, I mean, there are people who are stupid and gullible enough to follow almost anyone. And you can do that. Religion, of course, is abused in that way. But that doesn't mean to say that all religions you put under the same banner, nor does it mean that we can, absolutely as human beings, does it mean that because religion is abused, because there is an appetite, a spiritual appetite, if you like, that is abused, that therefore it's all false, it's all wrong. There's another myth he uses. I mentioned the myth of religious child abuse. I don't really want to go into the detail of that one. But that was probably, there were two passages in the book that just shook me completely. One was where he argued for the multiverse theory, because Dawkins knows that with the fine-tuning argument of the universe, you can't really say that it's highly unlikely that the universe is just the way it is. So in order to get around that, you invent the multiverse. You say there are billions of universes. And in one section in his book, and I actually laughed out loud when I read this because I thought it was a joke, and then I realized he was being serious. He said there are, you know, probably many, many billions of universes in one of these in which you already exist. In one of these universes, you are already dead. And in another, you have a green mustache. Now, that just struck me. I just thought, here's a man who's saying that to believe in an almighty God who created the universe and who could raise his son from the dead, but this is absolutely frankly ludicrous. And yet he's telling me that I'm alive in another universe with a green mustache. The thought did cross my mind, what if there's another universe where Richard Dawkins is a Christian? I mean, the multiverse theory has got to be that every possibility is included in these billions of universes. So I'm just wanting to be transported to that one, you know, go through the teleport or whatever. I mean, it was ludicrous. But the other passage that really astonished me was the one where he talks about religious abuse, not religious abuse, but sexual abuse. And he says that he was mildly abused by one of his teachers in his boarding school. And he then goes on to say that the harm that is done to people by teaching them religion is as probably as harmful as sexual abuse. Now, there are some horrific quotes in there, one or two which he qualifies. Lots of people get really upset with me for saying this. But I do think that Dawkins thinks that because I teach my children that the Bible is true, I'm abusing them. And I find that hard. And I'll tell you why I find it hard. Because if I abuse my children, I should go to jail. If I abuse my children, they should be taken away from me. And I think that the undertones of what he's saying is actually very, very frightening. That was the most scary bit of the whole book for me. Anyway, let me go on to say something just about one of the questions that I get asked a lot. And I want to introduce it with a story. It's an old story. Some of you may know it, and if you do, I apologize. It's the story of the atheist and the bear. Basically, an atheist is walking along in a forest, and he's a good atheist, and he admires the trees and the flowers and the birds flying by and singing. He's saying, oh, isn't this wonderful? When suddenly he hears a rustling, and on his right, he notices a bear coming out of the bushes. Big 7-foot grizzly bear who starts running towards him. So he says, I'm out of here. And he starts running. And he looks behind him and the bear's getting closer, keeps running, trips over a tree root and the bear's on top of him, lifts up a paw and is just about to maul him to death when he shouts out, oh God, save me! And everything freezes. There's no noise, the bear doesn't move, the leaves stop rustling, and there's a light in the sky. And he looks up and there's a voice that says, now! All your life you've denied me. You said I didn't make this. Now you want me to save you? And the atheist, who's quite a rational character, thinks, by the way, this is a story. It's not real for those. It's quite a rational character. And the atheist says, good point. Yeah, that would be a bit hypocritical. I tell you what, why don't you make the bear into a Christian? Okay, that's the deal. I'll make the bear into a Christian. So the light disappears, the birds start singing, the leaves start rustling. The bear stops and puts his paws together and starts praying. Oh Lord, we thank thee for this food that we are about to eat. So, I guess we would all want evidence. You know, you would say, I mean, and people often say, David, provide me with evidence. You know, let me be walking along the embankment and God zap me. And then I'll believe. Well, the demand for evidence is a very, very interesting one. And I want to just take a little bit of time going into this. I want to say, first of all, that the division that Dawkins and his followers make, and it is a real division, is where they say there are people who in effect live by faith. And faith, in Dawkins' definition, and it is his definition, it's not the definition of any Christian theologian I have ever heard of. His definition is, faith is believing something in spite of the evidence or contrary to the evidence. But that is not a biblical definition of faith. The concept of blind faith is not a Christian one. In fact, all of us have faith. And all of us place our faith based on evidence. Who's the couple I'm staying with tonight? Where are they? Here. You see, now I've never met... Sorry, what's your names again? Christine and Julian. Okay. I've never met Christine and Julian before. I'm going to go and stay with them tonight. For all I know, they could be mad axe murderers who have a passionate hatred for bald Scottish men. You know, they've already told me there's sweeties up in my room. You know, I'm getting... I could really begin to get in a cold sweat here. But I'm kind of working on faith. I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, they look okay, and the church has arranged for them to accommodate me. Maybe they've accommodated people before. Oh dear, all right.
There was that one guy.
Yeah. I like sleeping in... Yeah. Oh, they've got a garden, that's worse. Oh. I like sleeping on embankments. You know, I can't actually prove to you that they're not mass murderers. Not without a great deal of investigation, but I'm kind of operating by faith that really they're not. Okay? Now, what I'm saying is that virtually everything we do in life is a combination of faith and evidence. We act in certain positions on the information that we have. That is the same with Richard Dawkins. Let me read you something from this book. This is Anthony Flew's book, his reversal of his situation where he says there is a God. Anthony Flew, of course, before Dawkins, was the world's most famous atheist. This is what Dawkins was asked in asked by the Edge Foundation. What do you believe is true, even though you cannot prove it? And this was his answer. I thought this was fascinating. Dawkins said, I believe that all life, all intelligence, all creativity, and all designed anywhere in the universe is the direct or indirect product of Darwinian natural selection. It follows that design comes late in the universe after a period of Darwinian evolution. Design cannot precede evolution and therefore cannot underlie the universe. Now notice, he's saying he believes that. That's the foundation. In fact, that's the foundation for his book. That's the foundation for his life. That's the foundation for his philosophy. And he says he cannot prove it. Now that's faith. He might say that's evidence faith. He may say, I've observed. What he actually does is very interesting. He takes a principle of biological, of biology, evolution, and he works it back into cosmology and into everything else. But that's faith. And he admits he believes it and he cannot prove it. So I'm not going to buy into this whole thing of, Christians believe without evidence. Dawkins has just said that the foundational principle of his philosophy is something he believes but cannot evidence. Let me think just a little bit more in terms of evidence. You know, we often have a position and then we seize upon evidence to prove it. You know, you live in Bedford, for example, and I guess if I wrote a book in Dundee about why Bedford is the most wonderful town in the whole of the universe ever, it's not going to sell too many copies. But if I write it and sell it here, I suspect more people will buy it. Why? And more people will be likely to believe it. Because we're predisposed towards something. Now that happens with Christians, for example. One guy came up to me and said, hey David, I've got real proof that the world is only 6,000 years old. And I was going, okay, let's hear the real proof. And he said, population. Do you realize if you mathematically go back and do population, then it can only be maximum of 10,000 years old? And I said, that's proof? I said, what about plagues? What about illness? What about meteorites? How can you possibly say that? The reason he could say it was because he wanted it to be true and he was looking for evidence and he was hanging on to whatever he could get. Now, it's not just Christians who do that. I mean, that position is actually, frankly, ludicrous. But it's not just Christians who do that. Dawkins does that as well. Atheists do that as well. I mentioned already Dawkins taking the whole question of Fred Phelps. Now, by any standard, Fred Phelps is either insane or totally bad. And is someone who misuses and abuses religion. But Dawkins is desperate to have something to blame. And so he will use that. And other people do that. We all latch on to evidence to prove certain things. I'm desperately looking for evidence that... I was on a radio show yesterday, actually. And two very, very cheery presenters. You know, this kind of talk radio thing. Which was great, because they're all so cheery and nice and... They'd been having a wee chat about George Clooney and how handsome he was, and then I came on and I told them I looked like George Clooney. Now, I confess it was a lie, I think. But, you know, we were just chatting away and talking about different things about to do with Easter and so on. You know, I might want to convince myself that I'm incredibly handsome, and I can get lots of different bits of evidence that I can, well, maybe not lots, one or two bits of evidence that I can persuade my 10-year-old daughter, please tell me I'm handsome. And yes, I can believe it. And people do that all the time. But I want to ask, what is really evidence? And when people ask for evidence, if you're the kind of person who says, well, where's the evidence? Where's the evidence for God? I have to go back and say, what do you mean by evidence? Now, just forgive just a little bit of philosophy, okay? But this is really, really important because it's so infected our culture and so important. In the 1920s, there's a school of philosophy called the Vienna School. I think probably because it had something to do with Vienna. But anyway... Part of that was a man called A.J. Ayer, who wrote a hugely influential book called, in 1936, called Language, Truth, and Logic. And what he taught in that only things that were capable of being verified by sense experience could be real, or could be proven to be real. He said, a statement is meaningful if its truth or falsehood could be verified by empirical study. In other words, if you could scientific study, for example, the whole idea of the verification principle. What that meant was that the only meaningful statements, the only ones where you can get real evidence, are those used in science, logic, or maths. Metaphysics, religion, ethics, aesthetics. None of these have any meaning. They are literally meaningless. Ayer taught, to say there is a God is as daft as saying there is no God. The statement is utterly meaningless. You cannot prove it either way. And therefore, it's just pointless. Now, that's philosophy, by the way, it's called logical positivism. That died almost completely. It was predominant in Cambridge and in Oxford and throughout the academic world in Britain, and because of that, infiltrated the culture in lots and lots of ways. But actually, in the 1950s, that completely died because it was clearly demonstrated that it itself was a victim of its own philosophy. You can't prove that statement scientifically. You can't prove the statement that the only things you can measure scientifically are scientific things. You just can't prove it. It's a philosophy. It's a presupposition. A.J. Ayer himself, by this time in the 1950s, he was Sir A.J. Ayer. Let me read you what he says. Logical positivism died a long time ago. I don't think much of language, truth, and logic is true. You know, one of the most influential and powerful books of the whole century, and the guy who wrote it says, actually, I don't think it's true. And I've spent the past 50 years trying to correct it, he said towards the end of his life. Yet, the new atheism that Dawkins and Hitchens and others are bringing forth is a regression to that failed philosophy. And that's how you get atheists continually saying, you've got to prove it, you've got to prove it. And they mean it in a logical positive sense. They mean it in terms of science or maths or logic. They want God in a test tube. Now that whole philosophy is false. But you can't argue with people like that, because to me it's like arguing with a flat earther. If you've ever argued with a flat earther, or it's like arguing with somebody who says that Newcastle United are the greatest football team in the world. I mean, that's just such a matter of faith. You know, or my term, Scotland are going to win the World Cup. You know, it's just, you can't argue with it. Because in order to argue with it, you've got to accept the presuppositions that they have. For the Christian, proof comes in lots of different ways. And in my own response to Dawkins, at the end, I realize that this question arises, so I list about 10 different reasons or 10 different evidences for God and why I believe in God, and you can ask me about those in a moment. But I want to kind of finish off by just going through some of the, I think, major things I just can't get around. I tried to be an atheist. You know, for me, being an atheist seemed so cool, because when I died, that was going to be it. I didn't like the idea of having to answer to God. And anyway, God was too big and too confusing. And if I was an atheist, I could do what I wanted, as long as I didn't upset my mum or do anything illegal, you know. But that was the kind of whole aspect of things. But I just couldn't do it, because in my mind, I knew that there were certain things that were very different. For example, I understand even more now that the universe is rational and logical. There's no reason for the universe to be rational and logical. The irony is that if it wasn't for the Judeo-Christian view of God, or perhaps the Islamic as well view of God, you wouldn't have modern science, the science which Dawkins says disproves God, because the Judeo-Christian view said that there was an ordered universe. Now, that wasn't always the case. The Greek gods didn't believe that. But the Judeo-Christian view said there is an ordered universe, there is a God who created its order, we can study it, we can examine it, and hence you get Newton and all the rest of it that comes from that. The Big Bang Theory, I noticed in Scientific American, I think it was today actually, I read a bit on the thing that said the Big Bang Theory, you better get used to it because it's soon going to disappear, because in a few years we won't be able to examine it anymore, and people will question whether it ever happened. Now, the Big Bang Theory, there are people who say, you know, I hear Christians saying, oh, it's a terrible thing, and so on. No, it's not. The Big Bang Theory is the reason, for example, that Anthony Flew had to change his mind. Because in the early part of the 20th century, most philosophers believed that the universe was eternal. Big Bang Theory said, no, the universe had a beginning. And for Flew, that was a devastating reaction. You get Arnold Penzias, the Nobel Prize-winning scientist who discovered the background radiation that proved the Big Bang. This is what he says. This is an astonishing statement. The best data we have are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, the Bible as a whole. And they say science and religion are opposed. This is not Arnold Penzias saying I'm a Christian. It's not Arnold Penzias saying I can prove, you know, the Bible from science. He's just saying, look, the best data we have are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, the Bible as a whole. This is not an idiot. It's the man who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the Big Bang. I like Kurt Gödel, the mathematician, who says this: the world is rational. The order of the world reflects the mind governing it. The rationality and order of the universe is a huge pointer towards the existence of God. Number two is the whole question of life. And all I want to say about that is, how do you get life from non-life? Now, I want you to look at the table that you're sitting beside. And I want you to possibly imagine, supposing you look at that table for a trillion, trillion years, in a trillion, trillion universes, is that table ever going to live, apart from in a Disney cartoon? It's not going to live. You do not get life from non-life. Now, Richard Dawkins has an explanation of that. I think it's quite an extraordinary explanation. Let me see if I can find it. This is what he says. How does life get started, he asks. The origin of life was when the chemical event or series of events whereby the vital conditions for natural selection first came about. Once the vital ingredient, some kind of genetic molecule, is in place, true Darwinian natural selection can follow. How did this happen? Scientists invoke the magic of large numbers. The beauty of the anthropic principle is that it tells us against all intuition that a chemical model need only predict that life will arise on one planet in a billion billion to give us a good and entirely satisfying explanation for the presence of life here. This is what Anthony Flew says. I love this. Given this type of reasoning, which is better described as an audacious exercise in superstition, anything we desire should exist somewhere if we just invoke the magic of large numbers. Unicorns, or the elixir of youth, even if staggeringly improbable, are bound to occur against all intuition. Now, Dawkins is absolutely hoisted on his own logic there, or rather his own illogic. He's just saying, we don't know how it happened, but just give billions and billions and billions of years and billions and billions and billions of planets, and somehow the stuff for evolution actually occurred. There is no evidence whatsoever for that, the whole principle of life. Second, or the third thing, is consciousness. If you're still awake, you are conscious that you are conscious. Okay, we can all play mind games. I love the Matrix. Matrix 1, Matrix 2 and 3 was just weird. But Matrix 1 is just one of the greatest films I've ever seen. Just absolutely loved it. Now, how can you prove that you are really here tonight? How do you know that you're not dreaming? How do you know that you're not lying in your bed? Imagine tonight you're dreaming. Imagine dreaming about being here. But how do you know it's for real? Is this not a nightmare, this mad Scotsman standing speaking about God in this lovely place? You can't prove that. We could all just be wired up to some kind of machine that convinces us that an illusion that we are alive. But we know that we are conscious. We are conscious that we are conscious. We don't play those kind of games. And what does that mean? Because that table is not conscious that it's conscious. And I would want to argue, we have no evidence at all that any animal or any plant is conscious that it is conscious. It is conscious, but it's not conscious that it's conscious. We are. We ask these kind of questions. People say, it's just the neurons in your head. No, the neurons themselves, they don't make you conscious. They're part of the consciousness, if you like. Gerald Schroeder, the physicist, says this: there's no essential difference, listen to this, this is great, there's no essential difference in the ultimate physical constitution of a pile of sand and the brain of Einstein. No essential difference. How do we get consciousness in there? Dawkins admits this and says he cannot explain it, but one day we will. He accuses people like me of believing in a God of the gaps. I want to accuse him of a science of the gaps. One day scientists will understand everything. No, they won't. And consciousness is something you could argue is a great mystery, but I don't think science will ever be able to explain its origin without God. Another thing is thought, not just consciousness, but understanding, seeing and meaning. I can't remember who it is. forgive me for this, but somebody once said, the power of thinking transcends the material. The fact that you can think, it's not a material thing. You are not just a giant computer. I know that we have this illusion today that we think, well, one day computer, I mean, people get scared. Computers are going to take over. No, they're not. Computers are programmed. Okay, let me give you a classic example. If you have a DVD player and you're playing a piece of music, do you ever think that your DVD player will ever be able to appreciate that music? No, it plays the music. It may be able to make the music. It may be able to change the music. But the DVD player is not going to consciously say, oh, that's a lovely piece of music I'm playing just now. Again, only in Walt Disney World does that happen. In real life, that does not happen and is not going to occur. Let me read you. I'll tell you why I'm reading this in a minute. Let me read you something from Sassoon, one of his poems. Soldiers are citizens of death's grey land, drawing no dividend from time's tomorrows. In the great hour of destiny they stand, each with his feuds and jealousies and sorrows. Soldiers are sworn to action. They must win some flaming, fatal climax with their lives. Soldiers are dreamers. When the guns begin, they think of firelit homes, clean beds and wives. I see them in foul dugouts gnawed by rats, and in the ruined trenches lashed with rain, dreaming of things they did with balls and bats, and mocked by hopeless longing to regain bank holidays and picture shows and spats, and going to the office in the train. I love poetry, because it's not just words. It's words expressing emotions and feeling and thought. I think the fact that we can have that reflects something. Flew argues very coherently. He says there has to be a mind behind our minds. That's the only way that it makes sense. John Lennox, the professor of mathematics and the philosophy of science at the University of Oxford, uses the computer analogy, and he says, no matter how you run it, in order to get information out, information has to be put in. Now, that, if you want to read the best book on this whole debate, I would strongly recommend John Lennox's book, God's Undertaker, Science Buried Religion. Okay, I'm going to finish. I'm sorry, I'm a Presbyterian minister. I lie all the time. You never believe the word finally when you hear that from one of us. And there's lots of evidence, I believe, for the Bible. Empirical evidence, experience, spiritual, historical, logical, and so on. I think you can add up lots and lots of different bits. It all gathers together, and it all makes sense, at least to me, and I hope that you'd be able to see that for yourself as well. I put at the end that my greatest evidence is simply this. It's like, let's talk about marriage, or talk about love, or talk about children, and so on. Sorry for those of you who are single at this moment, because I'm just going to wax a wee bit lyrical about these things. You could be a very, very clever person, and you could persuade me, logically, that my wife didn't really exist, that my marriage was a sham, and that my children were aliens from another planet who fell out, you know, ET-like, and had been conned. I guess you could argue that. And maybe if you're extremely clever, and I was having a bad day, and I'm not that clever anyway, you might be able to logically persuade me. You're never going to persuade me, because I know. Because I experience. I know my wife is real. Okay? I want to say the same thing about Jesus Christ. People go, ah, come on, what are you talking about Jesus? He was this religious guy that did or did not exist a couple of thousand years ago. He died, and then all these kind of crazy people said that he was alive. And now we've got all these religious people, and look at them. Some of them have bells and smells, and some of them are happy-clappy, and some of them are dour Scottish Presbyterians, and they're all fighting amongst each other. And what do you mean, Jesus Christ? He's only a swear word or a religious figure. But for me, Jesus Christ is the absolute, ultimate evidence for God. This may astonish some people, and they get really mad. I'm as convinced of the reality and existence of Jesus Christ as I am of the reality and existence of my wife. Lock me away for this if you want. I've spoken to Jesus. I one day fully expect to meet him. He does give me meaning and purpose in life, and by the way, he hates religion too. You know, it's not religion. Religion very often takes people away from Jesus Christ. And for me, I look at what Jesus taught. I look at what he did. And it's not just subjective in terms of feeling. I mean, what I've said is, but I'm not going to exclude the feeling either. I just say there's overwhelming evidence. And it just draws me more and more towards Jesus. The older I get, and the more I engage with all these things, and I like to think, and I try and be as open-minded as I possibly can, the more I keep coming back from what I would call the darkness of the world and the darkness of the atheist philosophy, and the darkness of religion, and the darkness of human evil, and I keep coming back to the purity and the light and the glory of Jesus Christ. And there are many, many people, I've seen so much evidence of people having their lives changed by that. Now, of course, that doesn't convince you. I wouldn't expect it to convince you. But I would ask you at least to have the respect to say, okay, he really believes that. Maybe he's nuts. Maybe he's just been deluded. Maybe it's just a comfort thing for him, you know, some kind of spiritual dummy that keeps him going. But I would ask you to at least consider, maybe there's something to it. Am I deluded? Or is Richard Dawkins deluded in thinking that his faith, that everything in this world can be explained by the biological principle of evolution, everything in the whole universe can be explained by that? Is that deluded? Okay. We shall leave it there. Well, we'll now go for questions and comments, so please feel free to ask any question you like. I'll, for the benefit of other people, I will repeat your question. Make any comment that you like. I can't guarantee that I'll be able to answer it, but maybe someone else will. So the easiest thing is, I'm sorry it's a bit like school, but please put your hand up if you want to ask a question. Now, this is Scotland, and it was in my church. Everyone would suddenly take an incredible interest in their shoes. So, right, this lady, please.
Mm-hmm. And he says that it's because he wants people who have been brought up religious,
yes,
or conditioned,
yes,
to know that it's all right not to believe.
Yes. Yeah.
And I just wonder why you don't take his reason for writing the book at face value. And I am a Christian.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. One, and that's actually not the only reason. I mean, there are, I would actually accept that most of us, what we do is multi-reasons. But let me repeat the question. Richard Dawkins, at the beginning of the book, of his book, says that one of the reasons he's writing is to enable people who've been brought up in a religion to let them know that it's okay to leave it. And the question is, why don't I accept that as a reason? I do think that there are many, many reasons for lots of things that we do, and I'm sure Dawkins has many different reasons. I find that one really difficult to believe, and I'll tell you why. It doesn't make sense. In most cases, it doesn't make sense. Certainly not in this country. You know, and in the countries. Now, maybe in the United States, if you're a southern redneck and your family's all been Christian and whatever, then it's very, very difficult to leave. Or if you're a Muslim, you're not going to sort of wander in Iran and say, "Hi, I just want to tell you that Muhammad was a bad guy." That's probably not the wisest way to go. But I tell you why I don't believe that as a reason. Because I think that all of us, not just religious people, are brought up in the context of our environment and culture and family and so on. And all of us find it difficult to break free from that. We're not neutral. We all have things that are fed into us. And it's interesting. How would someone who was brought up in an atheist home, I asked Dawkins this in my own book. I said, what would you do if your daughter came back and said, "Dad, I've just been going to the Christian Union and I've become a born-again Christian. It's wonderful." I don't believe he would say, "Well, dear, that's just entirely up to you." I think he'd be spitting mad about it. And maybe he would let her. I don't know. But he certainly wouldn't be happy about it. Now, I've seen this several times, and I'm really quite surprised at this. This is Dawkins trying to put across the notion that what religions are doing are suppressing people and keeping people down. I actually find in my experience, even though my parents, for example, were strict Christians, on one level they belonged to the Christian Brethren, they let me rebel against that age 12. I just said, "I'm not going to church." And just to kind of, I was a bit stubborn then, a bit of a rebel, and probably still am, I just said, "And if you try to make me go, I will throw paper planes and pull people's hats off and shout." But I didn't need to do that because They said, okay, fair enough. And I mean, yes, there are cults, and yes, there are people who do things like that, but in most religious society in the West today, which is where Dawkins' book is really addressed, and to Christians, where it's really addressed, that's not the case. However, I've noticed a considerable intolerance coming from the other side. Let me tell you a couple of stories. When I became a Christian, I was about 17 years old, and some of my mates, we were, you know, sitting around listening to Pink Floyd records, as one does, and playing football and so on, and someone said, hey, some of us have become Christians, this is a great idea. Why don't we study the Bible as well? So we did. We didn't know that, we studied the Bible. And it actually, unbelievably, when we were listening to records, there was only four or five of us, when we started studying the Bible, eventually it came 30 or 40, 50 people at my house, meeting to study the Bible, and we would discuss and talk. We didn't know we weren't supposed to do that. We didn't know we were supposed to have a minister or a vicar or a priest. We just did it. And one night, there was a knock on the door. And in came this man who was really angry. I will not mention the name. He says, is my son here? I said, yeah, he's in the living room. And he came in. You, out. I thought you were going to an all-night party, and instead you're at one of these Bible study things. Now, you're home, you're grounded. Now, understand this. This boy was a 16-year-old boy, and an all-night party for us, in our lifestyle, in my culture, meant sex, drugs, drink, and his dad was saying, I thought you were one of these, and you're at one of these Christian Bible studies. Ah, nightmare. I've had parents who've come to the church in Dundee in St. Peter's, and they've come because their daughter or their son has started coming to church. And they're really scared. Have they joined a cult? Have they, you know. So, I would just counter Dawkins' argument by saying, listen, folks, it's okay to leave atheism. It's okay to believe. You don't have to be scared. People will ridicule you, yes. People will abuse you, yes. It's much more likely to happen that way than it is the other way. So, I think he's genuine in what he says, but I think it's grossly exaggerated, and I don't believe it was the reason, the primary reason that he wrote the book. Okay, anyone else want to ask a question? Sorry, were you just scratching your head? Oh, this is like an auction. This is like an auction, don't do that. Okay.
Why do you not address what I thought was the only thing that he said in his book, and mm-hmm. that was who created the creation?
Okay, because I find it really hard to do it without being facetious and sarcastic, and now I've got an opportunity to do it, so I'll have to. And because there were so many other things. There were certain things about the book that surprised me, other things that didn't. This one really surprised me. The question is, why do I not address what the lady here thought was the only thing in the book, the main thing, who created the creator? Now, what Dawkins does is he builds up in the first few chapters to the chapter which then says why there is almost certainly no God. And by the way, that title is a little bit too clever. People think, oh, well, he's being open-minded. No, he's not. Because he, as a scientist, knows that you cannot absolutely say absolutely anything about anything, especially something as unprovable as God in his view. So he's using almost certainly. Dawkins puts it very succinctly. He no more believes in God than he believes in the floating chocolate teapot around the earth, or the flying spaghetti monster, or the tooth fairy. I can tell you that Dawkins does not lie in bed at night thinking, I wonder if the tooth fairy really does exist. He doesn't believe in God. The following chapters then go on basically to ridicule all kinds of Christianity. Now, if I was going to write a book about the God delusion, what I would have done is taken an evolutionary approach. And what I mean by that is this. I would have climbed Mount Improbable by going step by step by step by step to prove that all the claims of the Bible, all the claims of Christianity, all the claims of theism were fundamentally false. And it would be a knockout argument if you took each one of them. But he doesn't. He goes for the big bang. He goes for the big leap up the cliff. And I'm still absolutely gobsmacked at this. And I was just a wee bit facetious. In fact, maybe it's easiest to me to answer this by just reading the answer. This is, right, the myth of the created God and the uncreated universe. Okay. I'll read, just read this. He talks about this killer argument, the holy grail of atheism. What is this killer argument, the one that even Nietzsche could not find? The argument goes like this. Evolution is true. Evolution explains the illusion of design. The design argument is the main argument for God, which, by the way, it isn't, but never mind. Therefore, there is no God. And the reason that the design argument does not work, the point that you think almost certainly proves there's no God, the core and heart of your intellectual justification for your emotional atheism, it is astounding. I almost feel at this point that there should be a drum roll. The argument is, who designed the designer? In your own words, once again, this is because the designer himself, herself, itself, immediately raises the problem of his own origin. Indeed, design is not a real alternative at all, because it raises an even bigger problem than it solves. Who designed the designer? But whatever else we may say, design certainly does not work as an explanation for life, because design is ultimately not cumulative. As ever, the theist's answer is deeply unsatisfying, because it leaves the existence of God unexplained. Now, it is clear this point is very important to you. This is me responding, and the foundation of the rest of your arguments. When I read it, I was genuinely shocked. Not because of its originality, killer force, or overwhelming logic, but rather because of its banality. Who made God is a question I would expect from a 6-year-old. Who made God, then, is the accusation I would expect from a 16-year-old. I'm genuinely surprised to find that the world's most famous atheist, now that the philosopher Anthony Flew has defected, and an Oxford professor to boot, using it as the intellectual foundation for his atheism. This is the argument that's going to change the world. This is the key. Forgive my incredulity and perhaps even a slight mocking tone, but you're very quick to mock some of the stupider theistic arguments. Using the who made God argument is the atheist equivalent of the argument from Degree. The answer to the question who made God is simply nobody. God is not made. God is the creator, not the creation. God is outside of time and space. Now, Anthony Flew says it's very, very simple. You have two options. You either have an eternal universe or you have an eternal God. There's either a lump of rock or a mass of gas or some matter that is eternal. Because you do not get something from nothing. Or you have a personal God. You have a design, you have a designer. Now, the logic of that for me is absolutely irrefutable, but Dawkins insists that this is the killer argument. Who made God? Who made God? Who made God? Well, I want to go, who made the Big Bang? Well, it was another Big Bang. Well, who made the Big Bang that made the Big Bang? Well, that was kind of another Big Bang. Bang. Well, who made the Big Bang that made the Big... You know, it just keeps going. And at some point you say, we stop. Or this regression, this infant... Are we saying it's infinite regression? But we know because of the Big Bang that the universe was created. We know that the Big Bang is the beginning of the universe. What was before the universe? What was before time? What was before matter? What was before space? Nothing. How can you... You know, so... Why I personally don't address the argument is I just regard the argument as being totally bizarre. And actually, Dawkins must know this, you know, because it is such an infantile argument from a philosophical point of view. John Swinburne is at Oxford University. I know that Dawkins has read Swinburne. I mean, he goes against theology and philosophy quite a lot. But who designed the designer is the infinite regression argument that from a philosophical point of view is a nonsensical one. So, I mean, I don't want to be harsh, but, I mean, I'm a farm worker's son, and even I can see that. Okay, any other questions or comments? This gentleman here, you're going to...
Yeah, I personally, growing up, I mean, I'm a Christian, but what he has done for me is given me a set of foundations by which to lead my life, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And now, at this stage of my life, I feel that I'm very solid, very set in my ways. But the atheist is also of that perspective, okay? Mm-hmm. Maybe his life has been without Christianity, his life has been without God, mm-hmm. You know? So why can the atheist and me be friends? I mean, what is the things that makes you special and makes him different from you? You know what I mean?
Okay, it's basically saying that as a Christian, he's grown up and a friend is saying he's got a solid foundation for his life. His atheist friend may have grown up and have a solid foundation for his life. Why can't we be friends? What makes him special and so on? I want to start with a basic presupposition. We're all human. That's what I would start with. And I would say that every single human being is made in the image of God, whether we recognize it or not. We are made in the image of God. I would also say this. It sounds like a cliche, but some of my best friends are atheists and some of my worst friends are Christians. You know, I mean, it's when someone comes to me and says that they are a Christian, It depends. Sometimes I'm asking, thinking, what do you mean? And I want to see that evidenced in their life and so on. I wouldn't want to kind of do what I think Dawkins does. I wouldn't want to put the world and say, here's the good people and here's the bad people, and the good people are Christians and the bad people are atheists. It's sometimes quite disturbing that I know people who are atheists who act more like Christians should act than some people I know who are professing Christians. So now, people then say, well, doesn't that make you question your faith? No, it doesn't, because this book tells me that's precisely what will happen. In fact, it makes me much more reliant on Jesus Christ, not on the labeling of people. And I think I work in the presumption all human beings are made in the image of God. I work in the presumption that every human being has had that image defaced, that there is something wrong within us. I work on the presumption that every single human being needs to be restored and needs to be renewed in that relationship with God. And that happens through Jesus Christ. But I personally have no right to act as God and to judge anybody else. I have no right to go around pronouncing people Christian or pronouncing people non-Christian or whatever that means. I just know that whoever they are, they're in need of Jesus Christ. And I pray that they would get to know him. So I just wouldn't make that kind of distinction. And I think as a Christian, you should be able to get on with lots of different people. I sometimes find that quite... I have a great self-defense, by the way. The Dawkins website has shaken this a little bit, but I still got faith. I work on the assumption that everybody likes me. Just that's my default position, okay? And unless you come up and slap me in the face, and even then I might say you're being ironic, then I'm just going to assume that... And it's a great self-defense. I know, of course, it's not true, but it's a nice way to be, just to think, well... So, yes, sir.
I'm sorry, but the reason why I'm saying this is because I come from a family that is half Muslim, half mm-hmm. Christian, right? Mm-hmm. So, I get it, for example, I'm speaking to Muhammad, and my own cousin,
yeah.
And he wants me to become a Christian. Sorry, he wants me to become a Muslim,
yeah.
And I want him to become a Christian,
yeah.
Right? And everybody in my family hates him because he's a Muslim.
Yeah.
I'm his best friend because the fact that he's a Muslim doesn't scare me. Now, when I speak to him, the only argument that I can find is that he sins. He needs Christ to be able to help him forgive his sins.
Yeah.
You know. But he then gives me all the other arguments from. So I think that a lot of. I mean, sometimes you can't really. Convinced, we just have to take them as they are.
Yeah, right, okay. Basically, again, just a very simple thing, that it's come from a family that's some are Muslim, some are Christian. Your cousin Mohammed, he's basically your best pal, but your family hate him because he's a Christian, and you know, you two discuss with each other, and you talk about Jesus forgiving for your sin, and why can't we just accept people as they are and get on with it? I have to say this, you'll forgive me saying this, but I would consider it to be profoundly unchristian to hate someone because they were a Muslim. In fact, I would regard it as a definition of... If someone said that to me, I'm saying, excuse me, sir, whatever you are an ethnic Christian, you are not a biblical Christian. You know, that's... When I first went to my current church, there were 7 people in the congregation. One man had 2 children, that had 2 teenage children in the church there, and I went to see him. And he said to me, he worked in a social work office, and he said, forgive me saying this, but he said, I hate the Pakis. I said, what? And I was asking why he didn't come to a prayer meeting, and he said, oh, I just see them, they're just coming to this country, etc., etc. I said to him, excuse me, sir, but I'm going to have a friend of mine, Gurnam Singh, who was a Sikh, he's going to come and work with me. And with that attitude, you're not welcome in the church, and you need to repent, because it's entirely unbiblical and evil. And, sir, you are not a Christian. And he was horrified. How can you say that? And of course I can say it. Because that's absolute blasphemy, and it's entirely against what Christ says. So I would argue, first of all, when people say they hate someone because of their religion, that is human hatred, that is ethnic, that is people using religion. It's entirely wrong. It's using religion as a label to identify a culture. And I hate cultural Christianity. And by the way, in a wider sense, I don't think we should engage as Christians in culture wars. I think it's a big mistake to talk about British culture as Christian culture. We need to defend that culture and so on. Actually, we don't. We need to proclaim Jesus Christ. That's our priority. The other thing I would say is, when you're talking to your friend Mohammed, I speak to the Muslim Society at the University of Dundee quite a bit. It's very funny. The first time I was there, this woman came up to me with the whole gear, you know, not the burqa, but the hajj. She was dressed, you know, very obviously, clearly a Muslim lady. And she came and she said, "You really believe the Bible?" I said, "Yep." "You believe it's the word of God?" I said, "Yep." "You believe that God is creator?" She said, "I've never heard a Christian say that before." And I said, "Yep." She said, "You know, you're almost a Muslim." And I said to her, "You know, you're very close to being a Christian." And we talked and had a bit of a discussion, and the leaders of the Muslim society and myself, we talked quite a lot. And I would one of them I go and play chess with, and I was going to say we're going to have a drink together, but not obviously an alcoholic one. I'm trying to persuade him to backslide a wee bit. But I'm still saying to him, "Whoever you are, sir, whatever your religion, you still need Jesus." And I will live with anybody. My next door neighbors are Muslims. And people say, "Oh, you've got to watch out, the Muslims are taking over the street." Because what they do is very simple. The whole family moves into one area. And into one house. And they save up, and then they buy a house a bit further down the street. And now they've got six of the houses in the street. And people say, "This is terrible, this is terrible." I'm saying, "This is great, they're the best neighbors we've ever had." And it's great because I'm here and I can share Jesus with them as well. And when it's Eid, they come round and they give us curry, and it's fantastic. It's the best thing about Islam. Is the food, you know. So, you know, I know where you're coming from in terms of the question, but I'm approaching it in a different angle. I'm not going to say that all religions are the same, because I don't believe that. But I'm not going to argue for cultural Christianity or defend it. I abhor it. But I am going to argue for Jesus Christ. And I've seen Muslims myself who've come to realize that Allah, and I use the word Allah for God as well, because it's just the Arabic word for God. I have no problem with that. That the best way to know Allah is through Jesus. And I know many Muslims. In fact, I mean, I can't go into this in any great detail, but I have a friend from one country in the Middle East who's planted 100 churches of, you know, hundreds of Muslims throughout Europe and in the Middle East itself. And he himself is a Muslim who became a Christian. We don't hear about this, because the country he's from, he'd lose his life if that was ever known. But God knows. So, yeah, right at the back, sir.
Yeah, we know through reading the Bible that God speaks through people.
Yeah.
Well, today, because of where we're at, as far as when Jesus said, "You'll know when these things come to pass, the world will come to an end."
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a movement going on in the world, and Satan is using certain people build, I would say, kind of like propaganda about Christians, just like they did to Jews. It's the same type of situation. That book that you got up there is part of that propaganda. And people today want to hear that. And it's all about saying, okay, these Christians are weird. These Christians have got a big problem. And they don't really belong in our society.
Okay. Just to repeat what you're saying, we know from God having spoken through people in the past that towards the end times there'll be all the things that are going on in the world right now, and Dawkins' book is part of that satanic plot, the propaganda saying these people are weird and so on. Okay. I hate disagreeing with Christians, but I am going to disagree with you. I think from the beginning of humanity, from Adam and Eve, there has always been this conflict between good and evil. I don't think that the Bible tells us when the end times are going to be. I think there's a great deal of harm being caused by Christians trying to second guess, when even the Lord Jesus said that he didn't know when his coming would be. I think when we try and second guess on the basis of interpretations of prophecies and so on, you know, I don't care when Jesus is going to come again. I'm just glad he is. And I think that it does sound, you forgive me saying this, when we talk about, for example, Dawkins' book as being some kind of satanic conspiracy, unfortunately that does make us sound weird and paranoid. I want to say about Dawkins' book is that I think it's just part of the general warfare, if you like, that goes on. And I don't want to say that Dawkins is inspired by the devil, but I do want to say that anything that is not of Christ is sin and is wrong. And I, you know, I pray for Dawkins. Let me tell you something. I got a wonderful letter from one of his relatives. I think it's not fair to say who. Who said, I loved your book. And he said, myself and Richard, and they're close relatives, said, I'm the black sheep in the family. I was converted and became a Christian. I know it's lovely. And he said, I spend my life as a missionary in East Africa going around telling people about Jesus. And he says, myself and Richard live in different universes. He said, that's what Richard told me. I think that's true. I don't want to put it down to kind of conspiracies or this is particularly bad at this particular time. Since Jesus ascended into heaven, there have been people in the Christian church who have been saying, it's the end now, it's the end now, these are the end times. I don't know if these are the end times. I'm inclined to think that ever since Jesus left this world, we've been living in them, but there may be a specific end time coming or whatever. I just don't know enough about that. All I know is that I want to proclaim Jesus Christ. And I have to say, by the way, and even if it was a satanic conspiracy, I have to say, Dawkins, or the devil, and I don't put the two as being the same, I think Dawkins has made an enormous mistake. Because let me just even put it personally like this. I stood in Borders in Edinburgh, and there were a bunch of Christians, and mostly Christians at that particular meeting, which is not always the case, but there were people saying, oh, this is terrible, look what's happening, our faith is being attacked. And I'm going, no, this is wonderful. And they said, what do you mean this is wonderful? I said, guys, don't you get it? Nominal Christianity is just dead anyway. We don't want to defend that. We don't want to defend cultural Christianity. But look, look up there, the number one book. It's the God Delusion. And why is that wonderful? Because it's a book about God and Jesus and the Bible. And because millions of people in Britain will have read that book. And because it gives you every reason to go to your friends and say, hey, what do you think of this? I said that in the Borders shop in Birmingham. And I said, look, you see someone reading the God Delusion, give them this or another book that's similar and say, hey, look, how would you like to see the other side? And the guy I was staying with, we were going home, we were at the train station, we were getting a train out to the suburbs. And he said, look, there's a guy reading the God Delusion. And before I could say anything, he took me on my word, and he said, sign that. And I signed it, and he said, right, wait for me. And he ran up to the guy and said, excuse me. He said, I noticed that book you're reading. He said, would you like to read another side of it? And he said, here, it's a signed copy. And the guy said, yeah, that'd be great, thanks. And he gave it to him. Now, that guy got a book in which the gospel was explained to him. He would never have read that if you'd gone up to him and said, I want to tell you about Jesus. So I actually think that what Dawkins has done is he's done the church in this country an enormous favor. An enormous favor. Because God and Jesus and the Bible are back on the agenda. So even if it was devilish, it's the devil making a big mistake. I'll let you come back, sir, and then I've got to come to this gentleman and then that gentleman.
Well, if the way you explain it is true, then actually what Dalton is doing is bringing people to Jesus?
Yes, I think. Bizarrely, you know, when the devil wanted Jesus to be crucified, what do you think happened at the cross? Who was behind that? Mel Gibson got it exactly right in The Passion. It was the devil that made Judas Iscariot do this. It was the devil working in the system of the Roman Empire and the cowardice of Pontius Pilate and the injustice of the Jewish religious authorities. It was the devil doing that, but it was God who meant it for good. Fabulous. And I think that's the same thing. This gentleman here.
Several times in things you said earlier, you used the expression, we're made in the image of God.
Yes.
Now, can you explain what you mean by that? Because it means nothing to me.
Yeah, thank you so much. Several times I've used the expression, made in the image of God. Can I explain what that means? Because it means nothing to the gentleman here. Thank you so much for asking that question, because it's one of the most misunderstood things. I've been lambasted on various atheist websites for using that expression, and people say, made in the image of God, and you say human beings are depraved, therefore God must be depraved. Or made in the image of God, and you say you're ugly, therefore God must be ugly. You know, made in the image of God does not mean, the Bible does not teach that God has a human body, arms, legs, and so on. Bible teaches God as a spirit. Made in the image of God means simply, actually, what I was saying about the evidence there, that God is rational, logos, logical, conscious, personal, that God is, we talk about the Trinity, which I don't really want to get into, but one of the key things of the Trinity is that God is in permanent relationship, so God is relational, and that we as human beings have all these characteristics. That we have a knowledge of good and evil as well. So that we are rational, we are conscious, we are spiritual, we are made for relationship. And for me, that is what the Bible would teach about being made in the image of God. In other words, we are not wooden tables, we are not plants, and although we are animals, we are much more than animals. In fact, in Genesis, the most significant part of Genesis that people miss out right at the very beginning is when they argue about all the other stuff which they're saying is scientific and so on, which actually, that's highly questionable whether it was ever written as some kind of science textbook. I don't think it was. But the most significant part is this, that the man became a living being when God breathed his spirit into him. That's when you live. I have buried many people, and I can tell you, I've buried people who are good friends, and when they're lying there in their coffin, sometimes in the Scottish tradition, people say, can we come up and see the coffin? You know, open the coffin, can we see the dead body? I always say to them, if you want to do it, you can, but I strongly advise you not to, because you're going to go and you're going to look and say, that's not my dad, that's not my mum, and it's not. It's not. They're gone. And what makes us persons, what makes us alive, is what it means to be made in the image of God.
I think you could argue that what you're saying is that you're constructing an image of God from our human characteristics, mm-hmm. and the other way around. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're saying because we're rational and we do this, that, and the other, and we love and so on, mm-hmm. you're saying therefore God must be like that. And that seems to be an equally valid argument. I wouldn't not necessarily agree with it, but you could take both perspectives, couldn't you?
Yes, can I make that argument? The gentleman is saying that we're saying that what we could say is that I am taking what are human things and projecting them on and creating a God in our own image. So rather than be made in the image of God, in effect, we're making God in our own image. Where that falls down is precisely in the fact that human beings have made gods in their own image, and they have had bodies, and they've had all these different things, often had human temperaments as well. You know, you don't want to meet Zeus on a dark night, that kind of thing. And I do think human beings do that, we project. Where I think this is different is the God of the Bible is so different in one sense from humans. You know, there is no indication at all of having a human body or human limitations. I remember a man saying once, I actually think it was an Archbishop of Canterbury, he must be one of the good guys, because he said, okay, if Jesus Christ wasn't real, I'd want to meet the guy who invented him because I'd want to worship him. And I think that your point has real validity, and we have to always be aware. And by the way, I do think there are a lot of Christians, we do that all the time. We feel something, so we say, well, look, God must feel that. And we attribute our will to God's will. And the real test of being a Christian is you bow before Jesus and you call him Lord, not you. You don't project a God in your own image. That's why, you know, forgive me saying this if anyone here is a Mormon, but I find the Mormon religion ludicrous because basically it was very convenient that Jesus happened to go to America and say that black people shouldn't get into the kingdom because that's what Joseph Smith believed. And, oh, by the way, he should have lots of wives as well. You know, I mean, well, that is people projecting. How is biblical Christianity any different from that? The old cliche. Religion is man reaching up to God. Biblical Christianity is God reaching down to man. And you have to investigate that for yourself. You've got a question. And there's a gentleman. Well, I'm going to... No, you're going next, because there was a gentleman here, I think. Was it? Yeah, and then... Yeah, sure.
All right. Does your Christian faith invalidate other faiths? Because although you've assimilated... Yeah. Islam into Christianity, which is very clever. Do you see other religions as being, false?
Yeah. Does my Christian faith invalidate other religions, and the gentleman believe that I've assimilated Islam into Christianity, which is very clever? Well, I'm going to be very unclever now and say, no way. I don't want to assimilate Islam into Christianity. My basic presupposition is that fundamentally all religions are at one and the same time, fundamentally true and fundamentally false. Now, let me say what I mean. All religions contain some degree of truth. When a Muslim says, be good to the poor, when a Muslim says there is one God, the creator of heaven and earth, I'm going, I'm there. When a Buddhist says, you know, we have to care for the sick or whatever, or material things are not the be-all and end-all, I'm there. So I would never despise any religion, say it's all of the devil, it's all entirely wrong. Also, with a lot of Christianity, the same thing. You can see lots of things in Christianity that were good and so on. But where I would say all religion is fundamentally false is because all human religion is an attempt, in Led Zeppelin's words, to build our own stairway to heaven. And we just can't do it. We always fall short. And that's where I would say that we need Jesus Christ. So, I mean, when I first started doing some work with Muslims, the local imam and a British convert to Islam, who was a professor at the university, we went and met with them. And the British convert was furious. You Christians are trying to convert Muslims and so on. And the imam looked at me and I said to him, sir, I do not try to convert anybody. And he looked at me and said, what do you mean? I said, I can't convert. It's only God who can convert. And the imam looked at me and he said, I agree with my brother. And I give the old answer of Elijah. The God who answers by fire, let him be God. I'm not interested in religion. So I will look at every religion and say, yes, there are things in that religion that I can appreciate, and so on. There are cultural things or other things I can appreciate. However, I'm also going to say about every religion, I'm actually going to agree with Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and say, religion does a great deal of harm. Religion without Christ is pretty close to hell on earth. That would be my view. I don't want to be religious without Jesus. I would rather be an atheist. So I'm vehemently anti-religious, but I'm not vehemently against the people who are caught in those religions, and I would say caught. So, okay? Sorry, yeah.
With Christ as the central figure, as he is, obviously. The Incas and the Mayans and the Aztecs,
yeah.
I mean, they had for, 3,000, 4,000 years, their own belief systems.
Yeah.
How come they were excluded from Christ and from the faith that you hold so dear?
Oh, dear, I wish you hadn't asked that question. Right, the Incas, the Mayas, and the Aztecs were, you know, before Christ, and how come they were excluded from that hold so dear? Two things. Nobody in their right mind would ever want a revival of the Inca or Maya religion with its child sacrifice and its, you know, its torture of human beings and so on. Their religion is actually a primary example of how man's search for God can so easily be abused and turn into abuse. The people before Jesus Christ, I'm very intrigued that the Bible says that Moses, long before Jesus, saw Christ. For the sake of Christ, he gave up Egypt in order to do what God had said. I'm intrigued that Abraham, I'm intrigued that Job, which is the earliest recorded book I think we have in the Bible, or the earliest story outside the first 11 chapters of Genesis, that Job says, I know that my Redeemer lives, and in the end he will stand on the earth. And though he slay me, yet I will trust him. Extraordinary level of faith. I'm astounded that Moses' father-in-law, who was a pagan priest, taught Moses about God. So for me, I'm looking at all this and I'm saying, look, there's lots of things I don't actually know. I know this, that people are saved through Jesus Christ. I've buried an 18-year-old child, the wee white coffin and everything that goes with it. Do you want me to say to those parents, listen, your child wasn't old enough to have put their faith in Jesus and say the sinner's prayer? No, I think that's absolutely ludicrous. There are lots of situations that I look and I say, well, God, I don't actually understand all this, but these things I leave in your hands. All I know is that no matter who they are, I mean, we had three miscarried children. I believe they're living souls. I believe they're now in heaven. They weren't able to believe or trust in Jesus in terms of their own mind and their own capacity. So there are a lot of things I just look at and say, I don't know, I've got to leave that to God. But I do know that for the rest of us, truth is truth, and we have to look for that truth and find it. And there is no salvation outside of Jesus Christ. That would be my own belief anyway.
One of the arguments that Dawkins strongly makes in the first three chapters is that God of the Old Testament is a capricious, evil, stoning kind of God. You haven't addressed that tonight. I know it's a question that many people have. You've got an Old Testament God who's quite an evil, violent character, and then you've got Jesus who's the nice and Jesus, meek and mild.
Okay.
How do you justify these two images of God?
Okay, the two images of God. Dawkins, he does this brilliantly. He attacks the God of the Old Testament, and some people have this contrast between the God of the Old Testament and the Jesus of the New. Very interesting that on his previous, he's currently on a tour of the US at the moment, but on his previous tour of the US, he often began his readings in bookshops with reading out this chapter about the beginning of, I think it's chapter 3, where the God of the Old Testament is a malicious, homophobic, malevolent, homicidal, you know, just a whole bunch. And when he finishes, people burst into applause. I'm intrigued. Why do they burst into applause? And I just think it's almost like some kind of escape valve. Here's the good news. Well, it's good news and bad news. Let me give you the bad news first. Jesus is much tougher in his teachings than any of the Old Testament prophets. You know, in the Old Testament, you could get in trouble for committing adultery. In certain circumstances, you could lose your life. Jesus says, if you even look at a woman lustfully, you're dead meat. You know, and well, that's us all gone. Jesus raises the bar, if you like, in the New Testament. Who teaches about hell? There's virtually no teaching about hell in the Old Testament. It's in the New, and it's not Paul. It's Jesus who teaches about hell. When he teaches about caring for the poor, for example, Matthew 24. Lord, when do we see them hungry? When do we see them poor? When you didn't do it for the least one of these, you didn't do it for me. Depart from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. You know, there's a big motivation involved in there. So you cannot make this dichotomy between the God of the Old Testament and the Jesus of the New. Furthermore, when Dawkins brought this out, I was actually starting preaching through a series on Deuteronomy. I didn't want to, because there are parts of the Old Testament, I'll be frank, I look at and go, oh no, how can God have anything? What does that mean? How does that? Do you know, in studying these things, you know what? I discovered the God of Deuteronomy, the God of covenant love and mercy. In the midst of all the things that were going on, the trouble with the kind of argument that argument that gets put is it is a very, very, very simplistic argument. And the world is not like that, and God is not like that. And the more I've gone on, I mean, the way I explain it to people is when I first became a Christian, after about a year and a half, I was staying in someone's house, and there was a book, one of these horrendous Christian books, 101 Difficulties from the Bible Answered. Well, I'd had about three or four. By the time I'd finished that book, I had 101 difficulties. They weren't answered at all. They just raised them in my head. All I can say is I've been studying the Bible, reading the Bible, and living as a Christian for nearly 30 years now. Yeah, I've still got some major questions and difficulties. I don't think I know it all. But I decided right at the very beginning, who do you think you are? You don't know everything. You're right to question, but some things you leave on the shelf. You don't say, hey God, you don't explain this to me right now, I'm not going to believe in you anymore. Because God's going to say, wait a minute, brat, who are you? Why do I have to explain everything to you? Well, because I'm not going to, well, big deal. So what, you're not going to believe in me? I mean, that, you know, it's that kind of arrogance. So I just thought, no, I'm not going to do that. And what I found is the more I've gone on, without taking away the questions, and without trying to fob it off, because I think there's a dishonesty that sometimes we have as Christians, and without ignoring what the Bible says, I've found that the God of the Old Testament is the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, and he's the God of the New Testament. And he's the God whose family we belong to. And I love the Psalms, I love the poetry, and even the historical stuff, which often much of it is descriptive rather than prescriptive. In other words, it's telling you what happened rather than telling you what should happen. I think you read it in context and so on, and it makes a big, big difference. So I'm not going to make any division between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New. Yes, sir.
And I believe that no other religion has got the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Does Dawkins explain anything about the Holy Spirit? Or requires, or?
Okay. The gentleman is saying that up until a couple of years ago he wasn't a Christian, he was on an Alpha course, the Holy Spirit day, he became to believe because, as you put it, you were zapped by the Holy Spirit. Does Dawkins say anything about the Holy Spirit? Would he have an explanation for that? Yes, he would have an explanation for it. He would suggest psychological abuse, misunderstanding, desire on your part. You just wanted it to be, you were told it was going to be, auto-suggestion, lots and lots of different reasons. All of which, by the way, could be true. You know, all of which could be true. We don't deny that people can be influenced in particular ways. The evidence of the Spirit being at work in someone's life is not even the gifts of the Spirit, it's the fruit of the Spirit. And that plays out over a long period of time. Dawkins, of course, would not accept that there's a Holy Spirit, so the question for him is entirely redundant. I think that you raise, though, a hugely interesting point, because, again, this is the question of the different religions. I had a very good friend, or a woman who became a good friend, I was in a church in the Highlands for 6 years. And she was a Jehovah's Witness, and she's a really devout Jehovah's Witness. And to kind of leave the Jehovah's Witnesses, and especially go to the church, because they're taught that the church is the devil. And even though she was beginning to have doubts about the Jehovah's Witnesses, what she did was she went to the Jehovah's Witnesses in the morning, and she came to my church in the evening. And we would sit and we would talk. And man, we would talk. We would talk about hell, and we would talk about Jesus, and we would talk about all the JW doctrines and where they disagreed with Christianity. You know, and from my point of view, I was stunningly brilliant. And she still didn't believe. I'm going, how stupid are you? You know, well, I couldn't really say that, but, you know. But she just didn't, she didn't get it. She didn't see my brilliance. And of course, it's nothing to do with my brilliance. I wasn't brilliant anyway. Just the arrogance of youth. Now I've got the arrogance of middle age. But one day, I saw her in church, and I think I was talking about the woman, the story of the woman at the well. And I saw her face. I've never seen this before. I saw someone physically transform before me. Just a whole appearance, everything changed. It wasn't like a glow or anything, it was just really weird. We're going out the door. She said, can I see you this week? And I said, yeah, sure. And I went up on Thursday of the following week, and I said to her, Christine, have you got something to tell me? She says, yeah. She says, I've become a Christian. I said, no doubts. She says, no, none whatsoever. I said, what was the difference? She said, the Holy Spirit. And I hadn't even told her about the Holy Spirit. She didn't even know there was supposed to be a spirit. She said, it just became abundantly clear to me. This is Jesus. Now, I could identify with that, because I was wrestling with this whole thing about, is it God or is it not God? And I'll tell you what I did. I prayed. This is really weird, because this is in between different parties and everything else going on. And I was in this rather strange church about midnight on New Year's Eve instead of being out at a party, which is normal. There was a digital clock on the wall, and I remember it went to 0000. And I just said, God, if you're there, show me and I'll serve you the rest of my life. When I went out, and honestly, I went out, and this is a town in the north of Scotland called Dingwall. I went out onto the street, and I did expect to be zapped, as our friend said here. And I looked up, ready to be zapped. There was nothing. There was no angel in the sky. There was no zapping. There was no nothing. Okay, fair enough. I went home. 2 weeks later, for some totally bizarre reason, I got out of my bed and said, I need to go to church. For some reason, I need to go to church. I know I need to go. I didn't want to go on my own. I didn't want to go to my parents' church, because I'd already rebelled against that. I was still a bit stubborn. So I got my brother up. He's younger than me and smaller. And I said, come on, we're going to church. He said, no, I'll get lost. We don't go to church. I said, we do now. And my first attempt at evangelism, I beat him up. And it was the most effective evangelism I've ever done. He came with me to church. So, well, I just, you know, made him come. And we're sitting in this church in the Highland, in a Highland village, and I could hear, literally hear the waves beating outside on the sea wall outside the church. I can't even remember what the minister was speaking about. They were singing a psalm out of the Bible as well. And just this overwhelming sense hit me. You absolute clown. You complete idiot. Of course God is there. How does anything else make sense? And that for me was it. It was just it. For the rest of my life, the second part of that prayer is the rest of my life. And now, I'm not saying that's going to happen to you, because the wonderful thing is God works in different ways with different people. But I tell you this, there's a wonderful promise in the Bible, and one thing God doesn't do is lie. It says, those who seek him will find him. I don't believe that anyone has ever sought God and not found him. I really don't. I think we run away, I think we hide, I think we don't seek. But the God who says, seek me, call upon me, and I will save you, is not a God who says, ah, you're calling, but I'm not going to listen. That's not Jesus Christ. I'll take one more question, then we better stop. Yes, sir.
You said that the publication of this book is not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
It puts Christianity back in the debate. It's an opportunity to communicate with non-believers and atheists.
Mm-hmm.
What then would you say is the largest challenge that Christianity faces? Like?
The largest challenge that Christianity faces is the weakness and ineffectiveness of the Christian church. Dawkins' favorite philosopher, Bertrand Russell, I'm paraphrasing, But once remarked that of all the versions of religion, of all the versions of Christianity, the one that made the most sense was what we would call biblical Christianity or evangelical Christianity. But he didn't believe it because he never met anyone who really did. I think we in the Christian church in this country play at being Christians. I think there are lots of social reasons and things that we go along at church. I think we talk about faith and we talk about God and we don't live it very much. I expect the world to be in opposition. I expect there to be satanic assaults, as our friend said. I expect there to be even possibly physical assaults. I expect there to be attacks in the media. I expect to be ridiculed. I find the biggest hindrance to the work of the gospel is often Christians, and or people who profess to be Christians. And the work of the Lord in this country will be revived when the church is first revived. And part of that is simply this. I think if I believe in Jesus and trust in Jesus, and if I believe that what the Bible says is true, then more than anything else, I would want other people to know that. Not going nagging them, you know, not attacking them, not trying to make a religious point, but just following Jesus, loving everybody, loving your enemies. You know, I do try and pray for... I don't even regard Richard Dawkins as my enemy. You know, I think there are other people who are more my enemy, but even if he was, how can I hate? I'm not supposed... You know, I have to not hate. I know I can, but I'm not supposed to. So if you ask me what the greatest threat was, that would be it. I'm going to finish by just saying this as well. I think we too easily buy into the culture around us, and I don't mean that by that music and so on. What I mean is we're far too materialistic. We're far too, what our friend here said, creating a God in our own image. Sometimes I want to say, I'm screaming out, Lord, give me reality. I don't want a fake Jesus. What was it? Johnny Cash sings a song, I think it is not from him, but it's him I remember it most. Your own personal Jesus. Sorry, you don't get an own personal Jesus. You don't get your iPod Jesus. You know, you get the real Jesus or nothing. Because the iPod Jesus is by definition false. He's yours. He's a makeup doll. But the real Jesus is actually at one and the same time scary, because he's Lord and you bow before him, but he's also magnificent and lovely. I'm going to finish there because the time has gone. I know there's one or two people with their hands up, but you have been incredibly patient. There are, if you want to continue the discussion, two things. First of all, this gentleman, sorry, give me your name again, I'm real. Simon. Simon, that's such an English name. No one in Scotland would get, if you came to Scotland, you'd have to change your name. Simon. Simon and his friends, talk to them. Because I know that they, I mean, I often say to people, what I do is talk about Jesus and try and remove some of the barriers that people have and get people thinking. But if you want to meet him, go to his church. That's one thing I would say. And ask questions. The other thing is, there are some of these cards which ignore the fact it says St. Peter's Free Church. I'm really not expecting you to go all the way to Dundee and visit this very weird Scottish Presbyterian church. Though if you're there, you're very welcome. But there are some of these cards at the books at the back and also down here. The reason I'm giving them to you is not so that you can phone me in the middle of the night, but so that you can send me emails if you want, if you've got questions that you want to discuss. I'm more than happy to do that, and please feel free to take them. Also, if you want a copy of the book, they are over there, and you're very welcome to take one. I would say to those of you who are Christians, do take the opportunity to give a book to a friend and discuss things with them. This book is not all the answers, it's just raising questions as well. And then finally, can I just thank you so much for your patience. You know, this is quite amazing. I'm usually not nervous when I go places, but you guys scared me enormously. And I have no idea why. Maybe it was the devil, but no. Thank you so much, and I appreciate your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Howard.
Just for all of us, David, thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us. It's such an incredible courage to set up and take questions on such a wide range of subjects. Thank you for that. Do get a copy of David's book at the back. And also pick up flyers for the other events that we've got coming up. Thanks so much for coming tonight. I hope you've enjoyed it. David's going to be hanging around for other questions as well if you want to talk to him. Thanks for coming.